In the studio this morning, I have Linda Wharton. Linda is a holistic, natural, and complementary medicine practitioner. She's a registered traditional Chinese acupuncturist and naturopath with her own holistic women's health clinic on Auckland's North Shore. Linda is well known as a health researcher, columnist, and author. She is a regular columnist at Mind Food magazine, Fitness Life, and the Australian Nature and Health. Linda's most recent book, Wellbeing, published by HarperCollins, is an essential addition to every woman's library. Its 400 pages cover many aspects of female health and well-being from a holistic perspective. 100 pages are devoted to the subject of breast cancer prevention, a subject that Linda is passionate about. So, kia ora and good morning, Linda.
Kia ora, Tim. Thank you for having me here today.
Linda, you've been in healing and medicine for some time now. Can you tell the listeners how you came into it?
Certainly. I'm actually quite long in the tooth now. I've been involved with natural medicine for over 22 years, which is hard to believe when I think about it. It's gone so quickly. It was almost an act of God, really, my getting involved in natural medicine, in the sense that when I was at college, my passion was writing. I loved writing. I loved creative writing. And I had my heart set on becoming a journalist. So when I was 17, I went on a big adventure, the overnight train to Wellington, and I went for my big nerve-wracking interview at the Wellington Polytechnic to become a journalist. And I was absolutely devastated a month or so later when I got a rejection letter from them saying that they felt that I lacked the sufficient maturity that I needed, because mostly they were older people that were applying for the diploma. And they told me basically to go away and grow up and reapply. And I was gutted. I remember crying for a whole weekend. And I decided that, okay, I needed to go away and grow up, so I'd go to university, and my second passion was psychology. I've always been fascinated by human psychology, the way our brain works and how we interact with each other. So I thought, okay, I'll go to uni. It'll give me a 3-year breathing space. I'll do a psych degree, which I duly did. And in my third year at uni, I got really, really sick. I got extreme fatigue, and I was constantly getting one infection after another. I kept getting tonsillitis, and I was just completely run down to the point of seriously considering throwing in uni. And I'd been to the doctors and had all the blood tests, and basically all the diagnostic tools had come back telling me that there was nothing wrong with me. So it was sort of all in my mind, apparently. And of course it wasn't. I was actually physically quite ill. And fate intervened in the form of an amazing woman that I worked with part-time, a lady called Mary. And Mary at that point was probably in her late 50s and had not seen a doctor for about 25 years. So Mary insisted that I go and see her naturopath. And of course at that time I was 19, 20 years old at uni. I had no idea what a naturopath was, but I thought, well, what have I got to lose? So off I went to one of Auckland's sort of forefathers of natural medicine, a guy called David Duggan, amazing old fella who's since passed to the other side. And David, it was just stepping into an altered reality for me. I remember going up this little windy staircase and sitting in a waiting room with all these little old ladies who had sort of bottles of carrot juice, and it was just totally something I'd never experienced before. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, David just looked at the way I was living, took a whole load of information from me that none of the doctors had asked me about the way I was living, and was I exercising, what was I eating, how much sugar and coffee was I having, etc., etc. And he just basically gave me a 10-day detox program, revolutionized my diet, cut all the rubbish out, put me on a few basic herbs and supplements, and after being sick for almost a year, within about 6 weeks, I just had a completely new lease of life. I felt so different. My energy was back. All my chronic throat problems disappeared, and I finished my degree. And, of course, with my little piece of paper in hand, I thought, I don't want to be a psychologist. I want to be a naturopath. I'd been so amazed at the turnaround in my own health. So I went travelling for a year, and when I came back, I went to the South Pacific College of Natural Therapies in Auckland and did my naturopathic diploma and began practicing. And the story doesn't end there, because after I've been practicing for a couple of years, I had another health challenge of my own, and I started to investigate Chinese medicine, which I'd never looked at before. And I had some fantastic results with acupuncture, with an Auckland acupuncturist. And so, being the perpetual student I am, I thought, right, I need to add this to my practice as well. So I then went to the Auckland Acupuncture College for 3 years. So now I've been 17 odd years combining traditional Chinese acupuncture and naturopathic medicine. So there you go, Tim. That was more than you were bargaining for, that big story.
But it's good. It combines the fact that you went through university, you also then took on a natural system, and you're now what you classify as a fully qualified, traditional, holistic, complementary doctor.
Yes. Well, not a doctor, because I'm not a medically trained doctor, but a natural therapist, certainly. And I feel that it's really interesting, but my long journey to get here, nothing has been wasted, because obviously as part of what I do every day, dealing with people's physical health issues, there is always a mental and emotional component to it. So even the psych degree I did, it's not wasted ground. That comes into it as well. So
completely. This is where you really can add another dimension to the whole way of healing, eh?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. And to explain a little bit more about naturopathy and also what we need to do, can you put a few key do's in for people that we need to be aware of so that we can get closer to a natural health? I know that sugar is everywhere, that our bread has got many chemicals and sprays on all our veggies, etc. Are there any key things?
Well, in my clinic, I work almost exclusively with women. I do see men, but the men usually get dragged along by their collars by the women, I'm saying. And they bring in stressed husbands or grumpy partners or whatever for some help. So my focus, my daily work involves guiding and empowering and teaching women new ways to well-being. And when you become aware of the multitude of variables and dynamics that affect our health, it almost becomes miraculous that any of us are well and balanced and, you know, healthy to carry on in the world. So what I do with my clients is, on a first consultation, I can spend an hour taking a case history. And then once I've finished with the case history and my client has left, then I'll actually sit down and do some research and some thinking relating to their case history, and I'll create a naturopathic program for them. And then in most cases, once we've put that naturopathic program into practice, I'll also work with them weekly or twice weekly with traditional Chinese acupuncture. So to get back to your question, the type of things that we need to address for well-being and that I address in the program are a really big focus for me on nutrition, because I feel that unless we are fueling our body with the right grade petrol, everything else you do in the way of massage or getting people to exercise or psychological therapies are greatly reduced in terms of how they can impact us. So we need to nourish every cell in our body before we have the life force and the strength and the ability to respond to, you know, interventionist therapies. So I'm really big on nutrition. So I'll overhaul a diet. I'm also quite big on nutritional supplementation, because I think even with the best of diets, unless you're able to source all organic foods, biodynamic foods, and eat them pretty much straight away once they're harvested, unless you're able to do that, then the quality of our food is suboptimal. So that's where nutritional supplementation comes in, covering the biggest areas of deficiency as well. And exercise is vital. There's no point nourishing a body with the best grade fuel and then just sitting on the couch for 24/7. You actually have to move the organism as well, because we're designed to be active, running, gathering our food on the plains. Of course, not many of us do that these days, but we go to the gyms instead. And the other thing that I look at quite carefully is sort of psychological and emotional and spiritual impacts on our well-being. Because what I see over and over again with women that come into the clinic, they can be going to the gym 5 times a week, they can be eating a reasonably balanced diet, supplementing, and yet still feeling very unwell in their lives. And quite often when I connect with them and talk with them and start to understand more about their journey, it's amazing how many women are sort of empty in their heart. And what I mean by that is, women and men are oppressed by lack of time and excess responsibility. And so one of my questions for my patients is, what is the source of joy in your life? What sets your heart on fire? What is filling you and nurturing your heart? And quite often they just look at me blankly and can't answer, don't know, don't necessarily have something that's filling them up. So I think that in order to really empower a woman to better well-being, we need to look at on lots of levels, so nutritionally, structurally, physically in terms of exercise and mentally, emotionally as well.
If there's no love there, and I know that a lot of relationships can actually become a bit toxic as a result, we need to be able to get out of that relationship or intervene with counselling, etc., yeah, to see if we can get to love each other again.
Yeah, and I definitely see that. I see that a lot. You know, women, I'm almost 50 myself, and that's my sort of main clientele, women in their 40s and 50s. And they've often been in marriages for 20 or 30 years, and they're really dead relationships. And I feel that they, rather than adding to a woman's wholeness and health, they're actually draining, they're taking the life force away from her. So I very frequently end up referring my clients to relationship counsellors to look at resurrecting their marriages, because that's a huge part of our well-being.
And on the whole, women are more flexible to want to learn more and to grow. I have a knowing that men, particularly the blokes, the Joe Sixpacks, are afraid to actually have a look at themselves in a deeper context.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, Tim. I think very much so that's a part of the Kiwi culture. I mean, it's a part of the male psyche wherever you are in the world, but it's still quite entrenched in Kiwi culture that men are good keen blokes and they don't sort of look at what's happening in their heart or their subconscious or their deeper levels of being. And that's one of the reasons that I love working with women, because women, when you lead them to that place and reveal to them that there is a deeper level of understanding and relating, even if they've never been there before, women are interested. They're open to learning more and to being guided. Whereas men, the men that I see, bless them, you know, they come and see me and they might have been sick or depressed or stressed or whatever for 20 years, and basically they want to know what pill they can take. What supplement can I take that's going to fix everything? And some men are open to understand that it takes a lot more than that. But generally, the women are sort of the leaders in terms of understanding a heart connection.
Because it's the thinking and the feeling. I mean, it was years before I realised that there's a difference between thinking and feeling from a bloke. And so this is one of the big ones.
Absolutely. It is, and it's interesting. One of the areas that I'm working a lot in now and writing about is breast cancer prevention. And although you say, we're saying that the women are sort of the leaders or carrying the heart energy, I see increasing number of women who are dissociated and out of touch with their hearts. They're becoming more masculinized, you know, more like men. We're sort of trying to live in a very male world where we're becoming CEOs of companies and cardiac surgeons and you name it. We're doing everything the blokes do. But I think it comes at a great cost to female well-being, and I really think that the dissociation from our hearts has got something to do with the ever-increasing tidal wave of breast cancer that we see.
It's interesting because Margaret Thatcher, her first legislation was to do with women and women's care, but when she realised if she wanted to get anywhere in the political realm, she had to become more yang and more male.
And she became more male than most of the males that she worked with.
That's right. And so here in New Zealand, of course, women have finally, in 1893, were able to obtain the vote. Women have been able to rise and make more headway through life here, and, of course, are reclaiming their power across all the realms within industry virtually, except there's not many CEOs. But women are now finding that they can take care of themselves and they're just going to have to go out and do it themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say, Tim. I mean, I'm one of those women. I'm recently married. I've got two beautiful daughters. I've got a very busy practice. I'm a writer, a speaker. I'm doing all kinds of things, making my way in the world and expressing my passion. But it comes at a cost, and I see that with the women that I speak to every day. And the cost quite often is that women get the feeling that they're not doing any one particular thing well. If they're excelling in their careers, there's a cost to their children. Their children are dropped off at daycare at 7 in the morning and picked up at 6 at night. And so women carry a huge guilt and sense of inadequacy around their ability to nurture their children. If women decide to devote themselves to bringing up and nurturing their children, then they cut off that other avenue of inspiration in their life, which is developing their own career. So seemingly we have it all, but I think it comes at a cost.
Yes, community. We need to get back to a closer community, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We live very isolated lives. I talk to my patients, my female patients, about who they have around them to help nurture them and care for them. And quite often women are doing it on their own. They're living at the other end of the country to their nuclear family. And while they've got sort of superficial friendships, they don't have deep, close relationships with other women that will step in and help them with their demanding lives.
So I think women, the mother and the father and the grandfather and the grandmother, all of them are there to help.
Yeah.
That just takes a huge workload off people.
It does. Mm. It does, absolutely. I mean, that's one up that the Indigenous people have got on us, and Asians as well. Even when they move to New Zealand, often they bring their extended family and
then
go back into living in an extended family situation. I really think we've lost something there, yeah.
So what are the challenges around health and women's health? When we have a look, there's plenty there, and there's one side is the pharmaceutical companies pushing their products, vaccines and pills, and then on the other side of the coin is the natural medicines wanting to assist women naturally.
As I've got older and stroppier, I have become more and more enraged by the corruption and the manipulation that I see with the powers that be in the pharmaceutical industry. And don't get me wrong, thank God we have pharmaceutical drugs. They are lifesavers. If you have had surgery and you have a post-op infection, once upon a time, too bad, you died. Whereas now you have an antibiotic and you live to go on for another 50 years. So in terms of trauma medicine, emergency medicine, infectious disease, Western medicine is the best of the best, and thank God we have it there. It has actually saved my youngest daughter's life along the way. So my passion and my message is not let's get rid of Western medicine, but let's understand its place, its strength, and also let's understand its shortfall and where we need to look in other areas. And Western medicine is about infectious disease, trauma medicine, surgery. Fantastic. It falls flat on its face when we're talking about chronic disease and when we're talking about disease prevention. So that's where a holistic perspective and teaching people that the decisions they make every single day cumulatively add up to their state of health. So that's the strength of holistic medicine. It's understanding that we are not just a body or a mind, we're an indivisible relationship between body and mind, and teaching people the skills to make the right living choices on a daily basis so that chronic disease is prevented many years before it is established.
Linda, there's things like female hormone replacement therapy, where mares urine, and then from there they had these mares standing in stalls and they took this urine and then they broke it down and used it to give to women. And of course it's lost its reputation.
It's fallen into disrepute in many ways. I mean, prior to 2002, the pharmaceutical industry had a huge captive market with an ageing population, increasing numbers of baby boomers moving into the menopausal and postmenopausal years. And menopause was defined by the pharmaceutical industry as an estrogen deficiency disease. And so, as a matter of course, once you become postmenopausal, you have this disease. You have the disease of menopause. So prior to 2002, when there was a sort of a groundbreaking study into the effects of HRT, once you were a postmenopausal woman, it was considered sound medical practice to place every woman on hormone replacement therapy. And this led to pharmaceutical giants like Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, who were the manufacturers of Premarin, having some of the biggest blockbuster drugs of all time. And all of this changed. The market crashed overnight in 2002 when the Women's Health Initiative study actually stopped a projected five-year study, stopped it at the, I think it was around the two-year mark, because it became so apparent that the group of women who were receiving hormone replacement therapy were experiencing much greater incidence of heart disease, stroke and breast cancer compared with the placebo control group who were receiving the placebo. And this news sort of reverberated around the world overnight, and doctors immediately changed their prescribing habits so that now very few postmenopausal women are on hormone replacement therapy. So this change in prescribing habits around the Western world is actually now translated into, for the first time in the last 50 years, we're actually seeing a drop in breast cancer incidence. In the 2 to 3 years after the Wyeth study came out, breast cancer incidence, new cases diagnosed in America dropped by 4%. And it's the first time we've seen that. And it, of course, reflects on the fact that hormone replacement therapy significantly increases a woman's risk of developing breast cancer.
And what about this cervical immunisation program?
Right, cervical cancer vaccine. Gosh, it's my favourite blogging topic at the moment. I feel quite impassioned about it. I have two daughters, 13 and 21, and I guess because I'm a mum, I have become extremely incensed by the misinformation that mothers are receiving about the Gardasil vaccine, which has been rolled out in a school-wide vaccination program in the last 6 months in New Zealand. And mums are receiving beautiful glossy brochures that are coming home with smiling-faced daughters on the brochure, basically being told that having this vaccine will protect their daughter from ever developing cervical cancer. And the advertising is so one-sided. This vaccine is actually a very controversial vaccine, and if anybody wants to Google Gardasil or Gardasil side effects, you come up with millions and millions of entries. It is hugely controversial. And New Zealand mothers are not being told this. They're just being told that if they care about their daughters and if they want to protect them from a potentially life-threatening disease, they have to have this vaccine. And the truth is that there is so much we don't know about this vaccine. It's actually being rolled out in a largely experimental form in young girls. The original trials that were done in girls age 11 to 14 were with a small population group and for a short period of time.
Which country?
Well, the original trials were done in, I think, done in Europe and in America. And so we don't know what happens when this vaccine is used in young girls, what happens in the next year, what happens in the next 5 years. What we are seeing from adverse events reporting in America is that the number of side effects, immediate side effects or ensuing over the next month or two, the number of side effects with Gardasil seem to be disproportionately a lot higher than equivalent type vaccines given to girls in the same age group. And there are now over 40 deaths around the world that have happened in previously healthy young girls within a matter of days or a couple of weeks after receiving the Gardasil vaccine. So my beef with the vaccine is that it's still largely experimental. For young girls, we do not know what the long-term effects are. We do not know whether it is actually going to, the antibody response that we see with the vaccine, we don't know if that's going to translate into a lower incidence of cervical cancer, you know, 10 or 20 years from now. And the other issue that seems to be just glossed over and forgotten in the media discussion is that really no woman need ever die of cervical cancer prior to this vaccine. So if a woman lives preventatively with all the measures, which I'll talk about in a minute, but applies the measures we know that reduce her risk, and if all sexually active women have regular pap smears every year or every 2 years, no woman need die of cervical cancer. And mothers aren't being told this. Mums don't understand that if they say no to a potentially dangerous vaccine, it doesn't mean that they're condemning their daughter to the risk of dying of cervical cancer.
And so the answer is for mums to get wise.
Yep, to get wise, to learn what they can do, to impart knowledge to their daughters about this disease. So cervical cancer, the vast majority of cases, are the result of transmission of a sexually transmitted virus, HPV, human papilloma. And we know that women who are sexually active are at more risk of cervical cancer because of their increased risk of being exposed to this sexually transmitted virus. We know that condoms greatly reduce the risk of contracting it. We know that limiting the number of sexual partners and having a sexual relationship within a monogamous relationship also cuts down on your risk of transmission. We know that good nutrition has got a lot to do with it. So girls who are, for example, eating diets lacking in folate, folic acid, or lacking in vitamin C and antioxidants, they're also at increased risk. If you smoke, if you take the oral contraceptive pill, your risk goes up. So there are lots of lifestyle factors, behavioural factors and nutritional factors that women need to know about and teach their daughters to prevent this disease. And of course, very importantly on top of that, women need to be regularly screened so that very early cell changes in the cervix can be detected and treated long before they become cervical cancer.
So the media could really assist us. It's not really getting out there, is it?
Not at all, because the loudest voice in the media, or the loudest voice behind the media message, is the very powerful voice of the pharmaceutical companies manufacturing and distributing the Gardasil vaccine. And so small little voices like my own are popping up all over the internet and radio stations trying to counter this powerful message to say that it doesn't have to be immunisation. There are other ways of preventing and detecting early this disease.
A whole lifestyle change has to come into being, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And I know that when you watch a lot of rock and pop music, that's also telling children to get out there and just have a good time, to heck with the consequences.
It's horrifying. As a mum of two daughters, I find it is a daily struggle to sort of bring them a message that counters the overwhelming message that they receive from every magazine they pick up, every time they flick over to Channel C4. The culture is a dangerous and damaging culture for young girls. They grow up believing that everybody's doing it and that it doesn't matter who you do it with. It's all just about having fun and a good time. There isn't a strong message countering that and saying, yes, but there's a really high cost if you live that way.
I'm speaking with Linda Wharton, who's also produced the book Wellbeing, a 400-page book that tells how women can take care of their bodies. Linda, can you tell people about this fantastic book?
Wellbeing is published by HarperCollins, and it actually was released now 2 years ago. It's gone very quickly that time. And it took me about 3 years to write this book. It is quite a mammoth tome, I have to say. When I signed my contract to write the book, it was for 100,000 words. And when I handed my manuscript in, it was 125,000 words. And I was duly told that they would have to chop out, 25,000 words from my book. And I couldn't bring myself to do it, so I gave it to them completely and said, you find 25,000 words that can come out. And 2 weeks later, they came back to me and said, look, every word that's in there needs to be in there, so we're going with a bigger book. So, you have the comprehensive story. It's basically designed for women of all ages. It's the kind of book that you'd read through once with interest, and it's easygoing. It's not a heavy medical, technical textbook. It's written for normal, everyday women that don't necessarily have a background in medicine or health. And then it's the sort of book that you put on your bookshelf and you just dip into it over and over again. Every time you've got a health issue or your daughter's diagnosed with something or a blood test comes back with an abnormality, this is a book that you pick up and you say, okay, what can I do to cure myself? What can I do to prevent this problem? And one of the things I love about this book is that it contains 100 pages devoted to the subject of breast cancer prevention, which is baby that's very close to my heart. Increasingly, I've become more and more involved in getting the message out there that we need to start talking about prevention, not just early detection and cure when we're talking about breast cancer. So the 100 pages in Wellbeing is teaching women and empowering women to make those different lifestyle choices on a daily basis to reduce their risk of breast cancer.
Because I've got a friend who had a lump in her breast, or a number of lumps, and she did her best to keep away from the health department because she found that they wanted to drag her in and give her a test which would lead them to want to do surgery. And she didn't want to have surgery because she didn't want to lose her breasts, the possibility of losing her breast. And so she kept right away from it, and now she's okay because she went, cleaned up her diet more, etc. And I would say that this is the best thing at the moment, to seek out an alternative view before you actually go into the system.
Well, that's a great story, Tim. And truth is that I think most of us that are involved in the health field know women who have turned their cancer around without recourse to surgery or radiation or chemotherapy. Those women tend to be the minority of women. Most women, when they're diagnosed with breast cancer, the wheels of the train start moving very, very quickly, and often within 5 days or 7 days of a diagnosis, they're in surgery. So there's very little breathing space, there's very little time for second opinions, for research, for speaking to holistic health practitioners. And so you're very strongly funneled down a sort of a 1-2-3 process of treatment with breast cancer. And my real interest is not so much the treatment aspect, although of course that's an area I work in my clinic, but my passion, my message I want to get out to women is that in many cases breast cancer is a preventable disease. And it seems almost that talking prevention in the area of breast cancer is almost a dirty word. I had a really interesting experience this week. On Saturday night, on the 17th of October, I've organised a breast cancer prevention evening at the Greyland Community Centre. We're starting, by the way, for listeners, we're starting at 7:30 and going to 10, and I'll be the main speaker, and we'll also have a presentation from Clinical Thermography, who are the new breast thermography clinic in Auckland, and they're going to be talking about the place of thermography in breast screening and keeping your breast healthy. So that is my passion. It's getting that message of prevention out there. And I've done quite a bit of promotion and advertising for the evening, and I had, in the middle of my clinical practice this week, the phone rang and I answered the phone, and it was a lady who wanted to know more about this evening. What am I going to be talking about? I sort of immediately got a strange feeling. There was something about the conversation that was a bit odd. And after a short period of time, she just completely lost it with me, basically. She got very irate, very upset that I was daring to put a message out there that breast cancer is a preventable disease. She told me that my marketing is misleading and that she's spoken to her oncologists who tell her that we do not know what causes breast cancer and we do not know what we can do to prevent the disease. So my message is diametrically opposed to the message that she's received from her oncologists, and she was very, very incensed that in putting the message out there that breast cancer can be a preventable disease, that I was shifting a huge guilt burden to women who have already been diagnosed with the disease. So my passion, my baby, I think it's going to be probably a lifelong project. Just letting women know that breast cancer is not a mystery. There is still a lot to be discovered, a lot of new information that we don't yet have. But there is so much that we know already that if women were taught this information and assisted and empowered to actually apply it into their lives, in the next 10 years we could halve or more our breast cancer incidence in New Zealand. I'm certain of that.
One of the things that I found with Cancer Incorporated is that they never ever say, we've got to clear up the air, we have to have unchemically treated water, we have to have a clean food chain, organic food, and we've got to eat as many greens and have as much fruit as possible. Mm. They never push that one because they're too busy behind the scenes researching, as they say, and using all their money to research and then finding a drug.
That's right. Here we are in October, we're in the middle of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and every publication you pick up, every radio station you put on has got something about breast cancer. And the vast majority of those messages revolve around mammographic screening, the importance of regular screening. They revolve around the importance of early detection and early treatment. And so little airtime or psychological space is given to telling women what we know about breast cancer prevention. This week I was online doing some research looking at how the funds are apportioned in America. Most of the data that we have access to, unfortunately, is American-based data because a lot of this research is not done in New Zealand. But I was looking at, you know, the millions, in fact the billions of dollars that are raised annually in the name of breast cancer research in Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And do you know that in America only 5% of the hundreds of millions of dollars that are raised are devoted to any kind of research connected to prevention of the disease? That's 5%. So the other 95% is channeled into pharmacology, drug research, improving surgical techniques, looking for new ways of screening for and detecting breast cancer early. So to me, this is insanity. It's just crazy. You brought up the issue of living in a toxic environment, and I feel really, really strongly that New Zealand women, they just don't get the message that we are exposed to a plethora of chemicals that are estrogenic chemicals that promote breast cancer development, and organochlorines, endocrine disrupting chemicals that disrupt our hormonal balance. And not only do we grow up being exposed to those, but we're born having been exposed. So newborn babies who have their first poo, it's called meconium, it's that disgusting black stuff when they're first born. And studies have actually analysed the meconium of newborn babies in Australia, not in New Zealand, although we're pretty much on a par with chemical exposure in the two countries. And they found that newborn babies have around 200 chemicals present in their first feces. That means that those chemicals, of course, have been exposed to the rest of their body and their cellular development. For example, nearly 80% of babies that are born have got lindane in their bodies, and this is a powerful pesticide that's used in many of our NIT treatments, you know, NIT shampoos and NIT sprays. And 80% of newborn babies are born with that chemical in their body, and it's a chemical that basically is stored in fat cells. It's an endocrine disruptor, so it will affect their development of breast tissue and their lifelong risk of breast cancer, and our babies are actually being born with it already on board.
Why isn't this information in the public realm?
Good question, Tim. That's why I'm here talking to you. It's not a popular message. Of course, pharmaceutical industry, agrochemical industry, petrochemical industry, these are huge, powerful, moneyed lobby groups. And so they have a much greater sway with government policy and government decision-making than few lone voices popping up, the Soil and Health Organisation or Organic New Zealand or health researchers such as myself, where we're kind of small voices in the wilderness compared to the powerful moneyed lobbies.
So Linda, you're talking about breast cancer. What is your message so that women can take care of their health and make sure that they never ever have cancer?
Oh, great question, Tim. I could talk for hours on the subject, and if women want a really in-depth analysis of preventative health, please, you know, everybody feel free to come along, bring your men folk if they're interested as well. Come along on Saturday night to the Saturday the 17th, Greyland Community Centre at 7:30, and find out a whole load of information that you probably will never have heard prior to that night that potentially is life-saving information. So just to get back to your question, Tim, what can women do to lower their risk of breast cancer? We've already talked a little bit about the fact that women are born into, grow up in and live in an incredibly toxified environment. So one of the things women can do is take personal steps to limit their exposure to endocrine disrupting and estrogenic chemicals. That means wherever you can, going organic, choosing organic foods. If you only have a limited budget and you're not able to go completely organic, choose organic meats and dairy products, and if possible, fruits and vegetables, but meat and dairy products for sure, because those animal proteins often carry greater residues of organochlorine and xenoestrogenic chemicals. So also look at the chemical milieu that you live in your home. So what chemicals are you bathing your body in every day? Women use an average of about 13 different personal care products every day, ranging from, you know, moisturizers, cleansers, toners, makeup, lipstick, body lotion, shampoo, you name it, the list goes on and on. Virtually all of those products contain endocrine disrupting chemicals, including parabens and phthalates. So know your personal care products. Swap over from the commercial products to more natural products that leave these chemicals out. That's just one area. Then we also know that a woman's body weight has got a huge amount to do with her breast cancer risk. So basically, with postmenopausal women in particular, the heavier you are, the greater your body mass index, the higher your risk of breast cancer. And we see what's happening around the world is that the countries that traditionally have had a really low incidence of breast cancer, like Africa and East Asia, for example, in the case of East Asia, as their society is becoming increasingly westernized and they're starting to put more Western foods into their diet, we're for the first time ever starting to see an obesity issue, and along with that we're seeing a rapidly increasing incidence of breast cancer in Asian countries. So the message is exercise regularly, keep your body mass index within a healthy range of about 18 to 24, preferably closer to the 18 end of the spectrum for maximum breast cancer protection. We probably don't have time to talk in great depth about diet, but we do know that there is a real correlation between a woman's alcohol intake and breast cancer, and anything greater than one alcoholic beverage a day starts to increase breast cancer risk, and this is for both pre- and post-menopausal women, and it's irrespective of your choice of alcohol. So if you're drinking, you know, two or three glasses of red wine a day thinking, oh, I'm doing myself a favour because it's loaded with antioxidants, then the bad news is that unfortunately you've misled yourself, and even with red wine, anything more than one glass a day and you're starting to go into increasing breast cancer risk. Then, of course, we want to look at the whole issue of our exposure to synthetic estrogens in our environment in terms of pharmaceutical drugs, HRT, fertility drugs, oral contraceptive pill. All of these things add to our lifetime estrogenic load. And about 70% of breast cancers are stimulated in the presence of estrogen. They're what are called estrogen-positive cancers. So we know that estrogen, whether it's produced by our ovaries or whether it's taken into our body through the food chain or through personal care products or through pharmaceutical estrogenic drugs, we know that all of those sources of estrogen stimulate breast cell proliferation. They stimulate the rate of turnover of cells in the breast, and in so doing that, they increase our risk of things going wrong, breaks in the DNA and aberrations that eventually lead to cancer. So the message is, look at your whole lifestyle, your diet, your nutrition, your use of drugs, your use of personal care products, and cut down on your estrogen load wherever you can.
And also drop out many things that are bought in packets and bought in cans.
Yes, that's a good point, Tim. That's another area, of course, is our exposure to plastics. We live in a plastic fantastic society now, so that you go into a typical kitchen and a lot of the foods are bought pre-packaged in plastic wrappers. Fast food, you know, microwave meals are all come in polystyrene or plastic trays, and people just pop them in the microwave and heat them up. People boil their water in plastic jugs. They store their food in cling wrap and in plastic containers. And most of these plastics actually exude residues which are highly estrogenic and potentially associated with breast cancer risk. In particular, a chemical called bisphenol A, which is used in the manufacture of babies' bottles. It's used for lining tin cans, and it's used in, you know, the throwaway water bottles that everybody drinks their water in now. And we know that the bisphenol A actually leaches out of all of those things into our food and water, and is highly associated with increased breast cancer risk and endocrine disruptions in newborn baby boys, testicular deformities and fertility issues in males. A whole plethora of hormonally related health challenges track back to our exposure to plastics.
And, of course, in the non-stick fry pan.
Again, you've got the... gets a bit scary, doesn't it? You can get quite paranoid about all of this stuff. But, yeah, non-stick frying pans, the Teflon surfaces, also, especially if you scrape them, put toxic chemical residues into your food, which are endocrine disruptors.
Because what I've found is that I've stopped buying any powdered product because of the fact is that they've used heat and they've... all sorts of things, and it's quite often it may be in a plastic bag inside a carton or something like that. So we've got to really, I'm looking at going closer and closer to the food chain, where it comes out of a garden.
Yes, absolutely.
And so if we're gardening, and I guess growing your own.
Growing your own veggies and fruit, wonderful. It's interesting with the recession that we're going through at the moment, there's been a really strong grassroots movement back to some degree of self-sufficiency and growing your own fruits and vegetables. And I think that's got to be a good thing for our health.
I agree. Linda, with the world getting faster and faster and job security, being able to survive and relationships up and down, where does stress come into it?
Yeah, very interesting. When I was researching to write Wellbeing, I spent quite a period of time reading other people's work, researching on the internet, looking at the whole question of stress and breast cancer, and is there a correlation? And what I came up with, I found really frustrating, because from a sort of a clinical research perspective, the message that's out there generally is that stress really doesn't have anything to do with breast cancer. They haven't been able to sort of prove a statistical correlation in clinical trials. But I beg to differ with that quite strongly, based on empirical evidence, based on 22 years of working with women in my clinic who are diagnosed with breast cancer. And what I see over and over again, probably, I don't know, 70 to 80% of the women I see who have got a new breast cancer diagnosis, sometime in the preceding 2 to 5 year period, have had a major emotional trauma in their life. And I mean a major, not just, you know, having a stressful job or having financial difficulties, usually acts of emotional separation, so things like separating from a loved one, losing a child, divorce, things that impact hugely on a woman's heart and lead to feelings of grief and abandonment and loss. I see that really strongly, that seems to be a feature in the preceding 2 to 5 years with many of the women I've worked with. And interestingly, from a traditional Chinese perspective, there is a real tie-up between our emotional health and the health of our breasts. So in Chinese medicine, the meridians that have the greatest influence on the breast health are the liver meridian and the meridian that nourishes the liver, which is the kidney meridian, or in Western medicine we think of it as the adrenal health, adrenal glands. So the liver organ in Chinese medicine is responsible for smooth flow of everything. So smooth flow of qi or life force or energy circulating through the body, smooth flow of our emotions so that we're not constantly going up and down on an emotional roller coaster, smooth flow of our muscles and sinews and ligaments, and also the digestive process of food moving freely through the body. And what tends to happen is when we are living in chronically stressful situations, living imbalanced lives where we're disconnected from our heart and meaningful relationships, acupuncturists see that this translates into a stagnation or a blockage of this liver energy. and over a period of time, lots of time, you know, years rather than months, stuck liver qi actually then becomes lumps, actually manifests as physical lumps in the breast. So there is, you know, without doubt, a connection between free flow of emotion, you know, being able to live a meaningful emotional life that's not characterized by sort of suppression and anger and frustration. There's a real correlation between that and the free flow of energy through the breasts.
And the Chinese knew about this thousands and thousands of years ago.
Don't we have something to learn from them? Exactly. For, you know, 3,500, 4,000 years ago they were talking this, and it's as relevant, if not more relevant today in the stressful lives that we live, as it was then.
So where do you get your support from, Linda?
My support. Where does my support come from? that's a very revealing question. Well, I have a wonderful partner, a husband, my darling Craig, who we've been married for about 8 months now, and he's hugely supportive. He does a lot of the background stuff, you know, keeps the house running when I'm out at radio stations, takes my daughter to her after school activities, does all kinds of practical things. I've also got a really close connection with my parents, who live quite close. So in a sense, we live in an extended family situation. They don't live in our home, but they're very close and we have a lot of contact with them. And yeah, close support with other girlfriends and other colleagues as well involved in the same kind of work.
So the holistic community you feel is coming together now, because there's so many different modalities for them to come as a group of healers.
Yeah, I mean, we all share something in common, and that is a desire and a genuine passion to help people find their path and find well-being in their lives. We have different tools, we have different access points to help people, but we share that principle in common, obviously.
And we can find Linda's website on
www.lindawharton.com.
Can you spell it, please, Linda?
So my name, Linda, L-Y-N-D-A, and Wharton, W-H-A-R-T-O-N. So www.lindawharton.com.
Excellent. What is your dream?
I guess my raison d'etre, my reason for being here on this planet, is to educate and enlighten and empower people, but especially women, because I'm a woman and that's where my heart really lays. Women to just see their own magnificence, to realise how incredible we are, how unstoppable we are, and that in order to be all that we can be, we need to have the knowledge and the ability to look after ourselves on a body, mind and spirit level. And so that's where teachers and speakers and empowerers such as myself come into play. We are the carriers of the message.